sacred duties of citizenship, either ignorantly or selfishly. Certainly Jesus in our age would not do that. We can do no less than take up his cross and follow him. The two men walked on in silence for a while. Finally, President Marsh said, "We do not need to act alone in this matter. With all the men who have made the promise, we certainly can have companionship and strength even of numbers. Let us organize the Christian forces of Raymond for the battle against Roman corruption. We certainly ought to enter the primaries with a force that will be able to do more than enter a protest. It is a fact that the saloon element is cowardly and easily frightened in spite of its lawlessness and corruption. Let us plan a campaign that will mean something because it is organized righteousness. Jesus would use great wisdom in this matter. He would employ means. He would make large plans. Let us do so. If we bear this cross, let us do it bravely like men." They talked over the matter a long time and met again the next day in Maxwell's study to develop plans. The city primaries were called for Friday. Rumors of strange and unknown events to the average citizen were current that week in political circles throughout Raymond. The Crawford system of balloting for nominations was not in use in the state, and the primary was called for a public meeting at the courthouse. The citizens of Raymond will never forget that meeting. It was so unlike any political meeting ever held in Raymond before that there was no attempt at comparison. The special officers to be nominated were mayor, city council, chief of police, city clerk, and city treasurer. The Evening News, in its Saturday edition, gave a full account of the primaries, and in the editorial columns, Edward Norman spoke with a directness and conviction that the Christian people of Raymond were learning to respect deeply, because it was so evidently sincere and unselfish. A part of that editorial is also a part of this history. We quote the following. "It is safe to say that never before in the history of Raymond has there been a primary like the one in the courthouse last night. It was, first of all, a complete surprise to the city politicians, who have been in the habit of carrying on the affairs of the city as if they owned them, and everyone else was simply a tool or a cipher. The overwhelming surprise of the wire pullers last night consisted in the fact that a large number of the citizens of Raymond, who have heretofore taken no part in the city's affairs, entered the primary and controlled it, nominating some of the best men for all the offices to be filled at the coming election. It was a tremendous lesson in good citizenship. President Marsh of Lincoln College, who never before entered a city primary and whose face was not even known to the ward politicians, made one of the best speeches ever made in Raymond. It was almost ludicrous to see the faces of the men who for years have done as they pleased when President Marsh rose to speak. Many of them asked, 'Who is he?' The consternation deepened as the primary proceeded, and it became evident that the old-time ring of city rulers was outnumbered. Reverend Henry Maxwell of the First Church, Milton Wright, Alexander Powers, Professors Brown, Willard, and Park of Lincoln College, Dr. West, Reverend George Main of the Pilgrim Church, Dean Ward of the Holy Trinity, and scores of well-known businessmen and professional men, most of them church members, were present, and it did not take long to see that they had all come with the one direct and definite purpose of nominating the best men possible. Most of those men had never before been seen in a primary. They were complete strangers to the politicians, but they had evidently profited by the politicians' methods and were able, by organized and united effort, to nominate the entire ticket. As soon as it became plain that the primary was out of their control, the regular ring withdrew in disgust and nominated another ticket. The news simply calls the attention of all decent citizens to the fact that this last ticket contains the names of whiskey men, and the line is sharply and distinctly drawn between the saloon and corrupt management, such as we have known for years, and a clean, honest, capable, business-like city administration, such as every good citizen ought to want. It is not necessary to remind the people of Raymond that the question of local option comes up at the election. That will be the most important question on the ticket. The crisis of our city affairs has been reached. The issue is squarely before us. Shall we continue the rule of rum and boodle and shameless incompetency, or shall we, as President Marsh said in his noble speech, rise as good citizens and begin a new order of things, cleansing our city of the worst enemy known to municipal honesty, and doing what lies in our power to do with the ballot to purify our civic life? The news is positively and without reservation on the side of the new movement. We shall henceforth do all in our power to drive out the saloon and destroy its political strength. We shall advocate the election of the men nominated by the majority of citizens met in the first primary, and we call upon all Christians, church members, lovers of right, purity, temperance, and the home to stand by President Marsh and the rest of the citizens who have thus begun a long-needed reform in our city. President Marsh read this editorial and thanked God for Edward Norman. At the same time, he understood well enough that every other paper in Raymond was on the other side. He did not underestimate the importance and seriousness of the fight, which was only just begun. It was no secret that the news had lost enormously since it had been governed by the standard of what would Jesus do. And the question was, would the Christian people of Raymond stand by it? Would they make it possible for Norman to conduct a daily Christian paper? Or would the desire for what is called news in the way of crime, scandal, political partisanship of the regular sort, and a dislike to champion so remarkable a reform in journalism, influence them to drop the paper and refuse to give it their financial support? That was, in fact, the question Edward Norman was asking, even while he wrote the Sunday editorial. He knew well enough that his actions expressed in that editorial would cost him very heavily from the hands of many businessmen in Raymond. And still, as he drove his pen over the paper, he asked another question. What would Jesus do? That question had become a part of his whole life now. It was greater than any other. But for the first time in its history, Raymond had seen the professional men, the teachers, the college professors, the doctors, the ministers, take political action and put themselves definitely and sharply in public antagonism to the evil forces that had so long controlled the machine of municipal government. The fact itself was astounding. President Marsh acknowledged to himself with a feeling of humiliation that never before had he known what civic righteousness could accomplish. From that Friday night's work, he dated for himself and his college a new definition of the worn phrase, the scholar in politics. Education for him and those who were under his influence ever after meant some element of suffering. Sacrifice must now enter into the factor of development. At the rectangle that week, the tide of spiritual life rose high and as yet showed no signs of flowing back. Rachel and Virginia went every night. Virginia was rapidly reaching a conclusion with respect to a large part of her money. She had talked it over with Rachel, and they had been able to agree that if Jesus had a vast amount of money at his disposal, he might do with some of it as Virginia planned. At any rate, they felt that whatever he might do in such case would have as large an element of variety in it as the differences in persons and circumstances. There could be no one fixed Christian way of using money. The rule that regulated its use was unselfish utility. But meanwhile, the glory of the Spirit's power possessed all their best thought. Night after night that week witnessed miracles as great as walking on the sea or feeding the multitude with a few loaves and fishes. For what greater miracle is there than a regenerate humanity? The transformation of these coarse, brutal, sottish lives into praying, rapturous lovers of Christ struck Rachel and Virginia every time with the feeling that people may have had when they saw Lazarus walk out of the tomb. It was an experience full of profound excitement for them. Rollin Page came to all the meetings. There was no doubt of the change that had come over him. Rachel had not yet spoken much with him. He was wonderfully quiet. It seemed as if he was thinking all the time. Certainly he was not the same person. He talked more with Gray than with anyone else. He did not avoid Rachel, but he seemed to shrink from any appearance of seeming to renew the acquaintance with her. Rachel found it even difficult to express to him her pleasure at the new life he had begun to know. He seemed to be waiting to adjust himself to his previous relations before this new life began. He had not forgotten those relations, but he was not yet able to fit his consciousness into new ones. The end of the week found the rectangle struggling hard between two mighty opposing forces. The Holy Spirit was battling with all his supernatural strength against the saloon devil, which had so long held a jealous grasp on its slaves. If the Christian people of Raymond once could realize what the contest meant to the souls newly awakened to a purer life, it did not seem possible that the election could result in the old system of license, but that remained yet to be seen. The horror of the daily surroundings of many of the converts was slowly burning its way into the knowledge of Virginia and Rachel, and every night as they went uptown to their luxurious homes, they carried heavy hearts. "A good many of these poor creatures will go back again," Gray would say with sadness too deep for tears. "The environment does have a good deal to do with the character. It does not stand to reason that these people can always resist the sight and smell of the devilish drink about them. Oh, Lord, how long shall Christian people continue to support by their silence and their ballots the greatest form of slavery known in America?" He asked the question and did not have much hope of an immediate answer. There was a ray of hope in the action of Friday night's primary, but what the result would be, he did not dare to anticipate. The whiskey forces were organized, alert, aggressive, roused into unusual hatred by the events of the last week at the tent and in the city. Would the Christian forces act as a unit against the saloon, or would they be divided on account of their business interests or because they were not in the habit of acting altogether, as the whiskey power always did? That remained to be seen. Meanwhile, the saloon reared itself about the rectangle like some deadly viper, hissing and coiling, ready to strike its poison into any unguarded part. Saturday afternoon, as Virginia was just stepping out of her house to go and see Rachel to talk over her new plans, a carriage drove up containing three of her fashionable friends. Virginia went out to the driveway and stood there talking with them. They had not come to make a formal call, but wanted Virginia to go driving with them up on the boulevard. There was a band concert in the park. The day was too pleasant to be spent indoors. "Where have you been all this time, Virginia?" asked one of the girls, tapping her playfully on the shoulder with the red silk parasol. "We hear that you have gone into the show business. Tell us about it." Virginia colored, but after a moment's hesitation, she frankly told something of her experience at the rectangle. The girls in the carriage began to be really interested. "I tell you, girls, let's go slumming with Virginia this afternoon instead of going to the band concert. I've never been down to the rectangle. I've heard it's an awful wicked place and lots to see. Virginia will act as guide, and it would be real fun," she was going to say, but Virginia, look, made her substitute the word interesting. Virginia was angry. At first thought, she said to herself, she would never go under such circumstances. The other girls seemed to be of the same mind with the speaker. They chimed in with earnestness and asked Virginia to take them down there. Suddenly, she saw in the idle curiosity of the girls an opportunity. They had never seen the sin and misery of Raymond. Why should they not see it, even if their motive in going down there was simply to pass away an afternoon? Chapter 12. "For I come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. Be ye therefore imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, even as Christ also loved you." "Hadn't we better take a policeman along?" said one of the girls with a nervous laugh. "It really isn't safe down there, you know." "There's no danger," said Virginia briefly. "Is it true that your brother Rollin has been converted?" asked the first speaker, looking at Virginia curiously. It impressed her during the drive to the rectangle that all three of her friends were regarding her with close attention, as if she were peculiar. "Yes, he certainly is. I understand he is going around to the clubs talking with his old friends there, trying to preach to them. Doesn't that seem funny? Said the girl with the red parasol. Virginia did not answer, and the other girls were beginning to feel sober as the carriage turned into a street leading to the rectangle. As they neared the district, they grew more and more nervous. The sights and smells and sounds which had become familiar to Virginia struck the senses of these refined, delicate society girls as something horrible. As they entered farther into the district, the rectangle seemed to stare as with one great, bleary, beer-soaked countenance at this fine carriage with its load of fashionably dressed young women. Slumming had never been a fad with Raymond society, and this was perhaps the first time that the two had come together in this way. The girls felt that instead of seeing the rectangle, they were being made the objects of curiosity. They were frightened and disgusted. "Let's go back. I've seen enough," said the girl who was sitting with Virginia. They were at that moment just opposite a notorious saloon and gambling house. The street was narrow and the sidewalk crowded. Suddenly, out of the door of this saloon, a young woman reeled. She was singing in a broken, drunken sob that seemed to indicate that she partly realized her awful condition. "Just as I am, without one plea." And as the carriage rolled past, she leered at it, raising her face so that Virginia saw it very close to her own. It was the face of the girl who had kneeled sobbing that night, with Virginia kneeling beside her and praying for her. "Stop," cried Virginia, motioning to the driver who was looking around. The carriage stopped, and in a moment she was out and had gone up to the girl and taken her by the arm. "Lorene," she said, and that was all. The girl looked into her face, and her own changed into a look of utter horror. The girls in the carriage were smitten into helpless astonishment. The saloon keeper had come to the door of the saloon and was standing there, looking on, with his hands on his hips. And the rectangle from its windows, its saloon steps, its filthy sidewalk, gutter, and roadway, paused, and with undisguised wonder stared at the two girls. Over the scene the warm sun of spring poured its mellow light. A faint breath of music from the bandstand in the park floated into the rectangle. The concert had begun, and the fashion and wealth of Raymond were displaying themselves uptown on the boulevard. When Virginia left the carriage and went up to Lorene, she had no definite idea as to what she would do or what the result of her action would be. She simply saw a soul that had tasted of the joy of a better life slipping back again into its old hell of shame and death. And before she had touched the drunken girl's arm, she had asked only one question: what would Jesus do? The question was becoming with her, as with many others, a habit of life. She looked around now as she stood close by Lorene, and the whole scene was cruelly vivid to her. She thought first of the girls in the carriage. "Drive on. Don't wait for me. I'm going to see my friend home," she said calmly enough. The girl with the red parasol seemed to gasp at the word "friend" when Virginia spoke it. She did not say anything. The other girls seemed speechless. "Go on. I cannot go back with you," said Virginia. The driver started the horses slowly. One of the girls leaned a little out of the carriage. "Can't we, that is, do you want our help? Couldn't you?" "No, no," exclaimed Virginia. "You cannot be of any help to me." The carriage moved on, and Virginia was alone with her charge. She looked up and around. Many faces in the crowd were sympathetic. They were not all cruel or brutal. The Holy Spirit had softened a good deal of the rectangle. "Where does she live?" asked Virginia. No one answered. It occurred to Virginia afterward, when she had time to think it over, that the rectangle showed a delicacy in its sad silence that would have done credit to the boulevard. For the first time it flashed across her that the immortal being who was flung like wreckage upon the shore of this earthly hell called the saloon had no place that could be called home. The girl suddenly wrenched her arm from Virginia's grasp. In doing so, she nearly threw Virginia down. "You shall not touch me. Leave me. Let me go to hell. That's where I belong. The devil is waiting for me. See him?" she exclaimed hoarsely. She turned and pointed with a shaking finger at the saloon keeper. The crowd laughed. Virginia stepped up to her and put her arm about her. "Lorene," she said firmly, "come with me. You do not belong to